Welcome back to Discourse, the weekly occult and esoteric podcast hosted by myself, Abamon the Great. This week, we are joined by friend of the podcast, Elijah, to discuss his personal gnosis and understanding within the Kabbalah of the Left-Hand Path, a personal journey he has engaged on in an exploration of the knowledge of good and evil. Breathe in, young magus, and let the work begin. All right, guys, welcome back to Discourse. I am Abamon the Great, and we have a guest on the podcast today. His name is Elijah. You'll notice that Dr. Ann Stone is not with us today, but we do have Elijah, and Elijah is, I guess you would consider, a left-hand path practitioner. It's something that on the podcast we sometimes talk about, but we don't speak of in direct experience because me and Dr. Anna Stone just are not really a part of that current, even though I did used to be heavily involved in it. So we have the guest on today. His name is Eli.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah. Hey. So we're going to be interviewing him. I guess, first and foremost, just so the audience kind of gets exposed to your areas of expertise. I mean, we have a relationship going back, 6 or 7 years now? Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah.
So, we met originally online, but we, mm-hmm. Live close together. We started hanging out, in real life. We've actually worked on magic projects together. We started a small, tiny little order.
We did.
Yeah.
We did that.
Yes, we did do that. And then we got kind of our paths
divorced.
I'm sorry
that went the way it did, bro.
Our paths divorced for a little bit and they're back together. So, I mean, we've done magic together. Mm-hmm. We ran in the same circles. And then also, exactly right. No pun intended. But we also are friends. We used to go bar hopping and play Dungeons and Dragons together and that kind of thing. So
we had some pretty freaking good times.
Good times. Back when I still had good times. Yeah.
Yes.
Now I'm now I don't partake in the bar hopping anymore. But
Well, you have a much more wholesome kind of good time now, I think.
Yes, very wholesome good time. I like my new life, my new wholesome life. But anyways, I wanted to get some perspectives just for our audience on the left-hand path, what the left-hand path provides you, why you engage in those currents. Let's first start, how would you describe your practice? What currents are relevant to your practice?
Are you talking about names, numbers?
I mean, above? A little bit of chaos magic, a little bit of Goetti, what's going
well,
on?
Well, I think at its core, most of my practice revolves around my own personal Kabbalistic studies. I grew up doing inductive Bible study literally since I could read and have, at this point, well over 10,000 hours worth. So I learned a thing or two. And when I got older and I was in school, I had some very interesting things happen to me. I had brain surgery. I had the back of my skull cut open and they removed part of my occipital bone and C1 to make more room for my brain because it was, ironically enough, too big and growing down into my spinal cavity. Big brain is not everything it's chalked out to be.
Yeah.
But I had a very, very strange Dante-esque kind of vision while I was under that I couldn't really explain with my current belief system, right? So I started looking, researching in all the different, religions, cultures, spiritualisms, etc. of the world. And then eventually I found Kabbalah and I said, wow, all that Bible study I did is now really useful. And so I've been working on fleshing out my own Kabbalistic system and seeing how it lines up with and can be married into the more traditional takes, as well as the Hermetic and Thelemic systems too.
Mm-hmm.
But the sense in which my practices are what one could call left-hand path, if there were such a thing,
mm-hmm.
is really around, thelemically speaking, accessing the will, because these, you know, like the seven deadly sins, for instance, are just desires up to a point in excess, you know, beyond what is, you know, considered healthy and sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's nothing wrong with a degree of interest, but that's not the same as like lust or greed or gluttony or the rest of these things. And I think that these spirits or attitudes that kind of fall upon us are the best way to gain access to the true will, because they're disruptive as they are, and the only way they could cause that much disruption within oneself, at least my understanding, is if they were stemming from the true will, because they come into conflict with so much of like the conscience and the conscious and the good, right? I think a lot of it comes down to, I believe firmly in the knowledge of good and evil is like an actual thing. I don't mean this in like a Christian sense of the word so much as I believe that the knowledge of good and evil, which is why we're all here today, it's two-sided, right? You cannot just learn from the good if you wish to possess true knowledge. God possesses the knowledge of good and evil. It requires you to understand. It's about understanding the duality between things and how to leverage both sides. And that's what gives man the tools to, you know, conquer and rule over the earth, like it says in Genesis 1. Because God tells all the animals, you know, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And then to humans, to Adam, he also says to conquer it and rule over it. Adam is then the one who eventually ends up consuming the knowledge of good and evil from the tree thereof. And now we have this very interesting task that man is given of, you know, refining the earth and working the ground. Otherwise, you know, we shall not eat, etc. To develop society and agriculture, right? And thus eventually civilization and technology and, you know, the present day. And as a day is to 1,000 years, and the good Lord created things in 6 days or periods, this would be to say that you could say that the timeline of man over the, you know, genealogies listed starting with Adam, which we're on year 5,786 right now, I believe. We've only got 214 years until the year 6,000, which is when, in a lot of orthodoxy, this is understood the deadline, I guess you could say, of when the Messiah will show up. And if we look at the order in which things are created, man is the last thing that God creates before he rests, right? At the end of the sixth day, which is where we're approaching. And now we're seeing all these advancements in, you know, technology and things that resemble humans. And so I think that in order to live up to the potential that we possess by virtue of being created in that image of God, is in attaining that knowledge of good and evil, attaining that gnosis. And so thus you could think of like Jesus in the New Testament as like the idealized, like realized human being who's realized their nature as a reflection of God, as a thing made after his resemblance, i.e. after his traits, his characteristics. It's what the tree of life is, you know, a map of. And as we look at this, we see it divided into these two sides. There's the Sephirot in the virtuous sense, and then there's the Klipot in the vice type sense. And so what use is a light if you cannot focus it, you know?
Yeah.
And like Kabbalah even itself as a word, or Kabbal, I should say, with the different vowels, right? There's different conjugations and different dictionary definitions, but one of the things it literally means is culmination or collimation, like of light, like as like a scientific term.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes this and it focuses it, and a perfect culmination or collimation, directing everything at a single point, is to have it collimated at infinity, which is what Ein Sof R literally is. It's the infinite light, and that's the ray, the Kav, that pierces after the Simsum. All right, all.
So yeah. I think just for the people, we haven't really touched on Kabbalah in a deeper sense on the podcast, just skirted around it, but the Ein Sof R, you're basically talking about the right before Keter, right? Right.
Yes,
right,
sir.
Yeah. So you want to explain a little bit for the audience, you know, Ein Sof R, yeah. Like the Ein Sof and so, the Ein Sof R.
The thing to go look up on Wikipedia is the Seder Hishtalshelus. Have fun trying to spell that. And it's the order of emanations. Mm-hmm. And in the Orthodoxy, they've gone through and essentially mapped out the journey of the Atzmut, the essence, the most primordial, substantive thing that is God, his essence, and how, what transformations it goes through, what things occur within it and to it that cause it to eventually become everything around us here today. The very end of this journey is the Tree of Life. There's layers upon layers upon layers of things that feed into it, but in short, it goes from being an essence to then being compressed or contracted with the Simsum, so the creation of the vacuum. You could say it's the before the Big Bang, which is when light became. And he said, let there be light, that whole thing. And then this divine light became captured inside of these vessels, which is fundamentally what the Klipot are, right? And the Kalim, for being more orthodox about it in this case. And it is then the ways that the light refracts inside of the different vessels and the ways that they relate to each other that dictate the nature of the Sephira. And so we get the Shevirat HaKalim after things are trying to be put into these spheres, right? And this is the shattering of the vessels, and this is where Da'at is broken. It's broken apart into pieces. And then all these divine sparks, which, you know, the remnants of the light, descend and fall into the physical corporeal creation. And the entire reason for existing or fulfilling the mitzvot, in a more orthodox sense you could say, is in the redemption of these fallen sparks, of these 288 sparks of holiness. Again, if you would like to Google that. And so that is the whole point of the physical exile, and it's about the redemption and the return. Now, why would God make things be this way? Well, sometimes to get things that you want, right, you have to do things you don't want to do, right? It's about a journey as well as the destination. And so this is thus where this shattering of Da'at is where Tov and Ra'ah, good and evil, come from. And so the whole reason, the rationale for interacting with the Klipot is because in order for those sparks to ascend, they must be encapsulated in some kind of a vessel. And so this is to say, the whole problem was that the vessel wasn't strong enough to hold the sparks in the first place. So if you want to be able to hold the sparks, you're going to have to make something stronger than what it was. And this requires a strengthening of the will, which is what emanates from Keter and is itself constraint, and is what allows for us to assert our will on the world, other people, whatever. To do something left-handed would be to forcibly subject someone to something, which can be as simple as just being annoying and talking about things they don't care about. Sorry if that's the case.
No.
Or it could be something as serious as some pretty messed up criminal offenses that, you know, people have had to deal with.
Like conspiracy theory fodder, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That, like just, the dark occultists that are doing, you know, messed up rituals. And,
The thing, the whole satanic panic.
Yeah.
There are those people. I'm not one of those people.
Yeah, I think those are some personally, I think those are some pretty bad wizards, because within my experience, you can get the same rewards without having to, you know, subject. You can get the same material outcomes from from practical magic without having to subject anybody to some terrible abuse.
Right. What happened to occulting or concealing something, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's to hide it inside of a klipa.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the other things this word actually means, the root word klipa in Hebrew, is parchment, something that's written on, and specifically also playing cards, like the backs of playing cards.
Uh-huh.
The Sitra Achra of the number, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which conceals it. You don't know what's inside. It's a loot box.
Yeah. It's a loot box.
It's a spiritual loot box.
Spiritual loot box. Oh. Okay, so you're saying the Klipa are spiritual loot boxes.
There you go. All that. That's the TLDR. Okay.
Yeah, so I guess like what you're saying is that your exploration into kind of the darker left-hand aspects of the occult and magic and esotericism is more about exploring those klipa and finding God within them.
Absolutely. And this is like what's referred to as the running and the returning, which you see all throughout, you know, rabbinical literature, and especially in like Ezekiel 1, with the lightning that's running and returning between the living creatures and the chariot. That's a whole thing. I encourage you all to go give that one a read if you haven't. It's pretty short.
Yeah.
The word for running, ratzon, is the same as the word for will or intention. And so this is when it has the like kochos or kochot hanefesh, the powers of the soul, like in Orthodoxy.
Yeah.
Like the inner aspect of Hesed is achava, of grace is love, right? Of keter, of the crown, is ratzon, which is the will, right? And there's actually three in there. It's the outermost of the three. Not going to get into the other two because that's gonna make this take way too long. But the word for returning, shub, is the root of the word teshuva, the word for repentance, to return, to turn around, right?
Yeah.
So the running and the returning.
Uh-huh.
And it's the emanation and the oscillation of the voice of God throughout creation, right? And it's the flow of the creative force as it is evolving and emanating through nature. And this, you could say, is the big current, right?
Yeah.
It's the collective movement of the proverbial ocean. And by proverbial, I mean the biblical ocean, which was obviously not water, you know, on like here, like how do you have days if the sun wasn't created until, you know, the fourth day? How does that work, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's because these words are so multifaceted in their meanings that when you attempt to translate them, what they've done is they've stuck with the vowel points that are present in the texts that they've discovered. And like the Masoretic text is a big one. But the older copies of the Torah and just of the Bible and such that we have don't have any such vowel points.
Yes.
And these can lead to some huge different alternative translations. And it's because of Pardes. There's a multifaceted way of dissecting it.
I think where it's like just it's frustrating and destructive to theology and the theologian. It is the what makes it empowers the magician. You know, the magician who the magician or the mystic, because they don't have like the vowels aren't in there in the
right.
In
it
literature.
Gives you flexibility.
Yeah.
And so you can impro.
It's esoteric. It gives you freedom for esotericism.
It's a secret, hidden, multifaceted, encrypted meaning that can only be grasped by understanding all of the different ways you could permute the vowels on a word that are used for anything, right?
Yeah.
And it's how you encantulate, you know, how you enchant, and you put the chant in enchant, right?
Yes.
And
Now, yeah. I think this is that's something, because you see, at least within Thelema, stuff that's descended from Crowley. Crowley actually leaned pretty heavily into those vowel sounds as the main operators of the language of magic. And then that actually goes all the way, that goes to Greco-Egyptian magic, like within the PGM, right? Mm-hmm. So it's where, I mean, if you're doing like Kabbalah or Jewish mysticism or Jewish magic earlier than Kabbalah, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot more about the extracting the meaning from the consonants, and then the vowels are linking the consonants. Whereas if you look at the more magical ways to use language, they do a heavy emphasis on what vowels are being used.
Right. Yeah. And the vowels are, you know, the nekudot, the dots, right? Are 1-to-1 compared against the Sephirot a great number of times. And so thus to manipulate the Sephirot to move the fingers upon the hands of God, which you have four of, actually.
Yes,
so,
yes.
That is
to, did I tell you about what I want to do on the other hand?
No.
I want to do Aya. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? On the left hand? Aya for the left hand?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I believe that. I believe more in the IKEA interpretation of Kabbalah, of it's a bunch of pieces and you can put it together however you can put it together, right? And the problem is you just have several thousand years of people arguing at you, and most people have probably already thought of what you've done. And now that doesn't mean the orthodoxy is all 100%
I actually it's funny, I've actually kind of fallen in love, I think, in the past year or two with the Baal Shem Tov and the Hasids. I know, and everybody, I know, it's like, it's
I will so now funny. Claim to be left-hand path at this point. Yeah. I'm not the Baal Shem Tov.
I like the blatant panentheism that's within Hasidus and everything.
It's great.
That's how that's how I understand my relationship with the creator, the Abrahamic God, which I'm, you know, that's my Mac. That's my God with a capital G. That's my cosmos.
Hell yeah.
Whatever you want to say. It's the Abrahamic one. Sorry, guys. But
if it was, there were any other true God, he would have printed more books.
Yeah, exactly. But there's the problem is, in most Abrahamic religion, there's no panentheistic understanding, and that's actually a heresy.
Absolutely. God is within, you cannot read the Bible and come away with some other conclusion. You got to put on the blinders for that one.
Yeah, exactly. And but when I found within my practical magic, or like when I practically use Kabbalah, because I'm I'm very much about practical Kabbalah. I don't lean into the gematria or the theology as much, and like trying to come up with a system. I'm very practical about it in experiencing the creator through the use of that magical or holy sacred alphabet.
You're more of an Asiya kind of guy.
An Asiya, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I feel my experience in those practices has kind of led me into a panentheistic understanding, because it's like, yes, I do not know the creator in his fullness, but I've been able to find glimpses of him. And, you know, what you're saying, especially within, you know, finding God within the cliff out or something, that's one of the things through initiation that you're taught. It's like within the suffering, like suffering does not have to be suffering. Suffering, you can turn suffering into just pain with God present, as if you can find God within the suffering.
And that's what the story of Jesus really, really highlights, I think, more than anything else.
Yeah,
especially towards the end there.
Yeah, exactly.
Spoiler.
I haven't
spoil
done
it, guys.
The,
I won't tell you how it ends.
I haven't done the esoteric Christian thing in, God, it's got to be like 8 years or something.
I think that the New Testament, and this is a pretty heretical opinion that I have, I think the New Testament is nothing more than the greatest, or I should say most successfully recognized Kabbalistic manuscript devised to man.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Because
that's a hot take.
Okay, so the cross, right?
Yes.
What letter is the cross?
A tau. Oh, tau. Yeah.
What letter is the nail?
The resh?
Vav.
The vav. Oh, yeah, the vav. Yeah.
What letter is the hand?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yod.
Yod. Okay. Yeah.
And so the crucifixion is like a spell.
Oh, got it. Oh, there you go. There you go.
You know, there's like 12 tribes and then this invisible thing between them, right? Uh-huh. And like in barbershop harmony, right, there's the voice of God, which is what you get when you synchronize, you know, and have these various different parts of the chord in yeah. perfect attenuation with each other. You get this overtone, right? Yeah. Plato was a literary figure created by Aristotle, right?
Was he?
That's my personal opinion. Also, your personal probably heretical. Opinion?
I'm a hardcore Platonist.
Oh no, I'm me too. I just don't believe that he's real.
You don't believe that he's real?
Plato was a character.
You think he was a character?
I think the same thing about Jesus. I believe wholeheartedly the disciples, you know, were real people.
Yeah.
And they were like Jesus was like the shared spirit thereof, of such a group. And they did go on to write something very inspired.
Well, how
if it wasn't inspired, how would it be this widespread and cause this much change in the world?
How did the Academy at Athens, like, you know, those that succeeded Plato or whatever. Mm-hmm. How did Aristotle pull that off? You know,
he was probably a wizard.
He was a wizard. Aristotle was a wizard,
bro.
Yeah, he was I guess
he possessed as much philo for Sophia. Okay.
Yeah, I know. I know. There's the very like mundane way to look at it that Aristotle's the Greek philosopher for scientists and rationalists and stuff. But when you look at Aristotle, and especially when you look at like Arabic magic and hermeticism and that kind of thing, Aristotle's actually infused into the magical tradition a lot.
And I'm very happy. Before, the closest thing to anything esoteric that I believed in and like actively, continue to learn about when I was younger was Platonism, and especially Neoplatonism. I didn't, necessarily reach all the same conclusions. That's why I eventually progress past that, as we all should. Don't get trapped in your ideology.
Yes, exactly. Kids. That's the thing.
Don't do it.
It's like Neoplatonism. Like Platonism, if you were to peg me on a spectrum, a lot of people would call me a Platonist. However, there's I don't accept the three hypostases of Plotinus. I don't. Everything else, like the Enneads, is like that is a masterpiece of like exploring what mysticism is or whatever. But I think the second hypostasis, that the intellect or whatever, the divine intellect, or that that's like one of the things that I have not been able to reconcile through mystic experience. And so I'm not gonna sit there. And so like don't subscribe. I'm a magician. I do not subscribe. The reason I'm a magician is because I don't subscribe to an ideology or a theology or a religion, but I'm inspired by all of them.
To be a magician requires you to be pretty mercurial or something.
Yeah. Or
something.
Yeah. It's very much. But yeah, so you don't, don't subscribe. Like the second you subscribe, like I'm a Platonist, you limit
to this
yourself.
Man, though.
Yeah.
Don't subscribe to anything else. Just him.
Just the YouTube.
Just the YouTube.
Yeah, just subscribe.
Not the ideas,
yeah,
just
not
the YouTube.
The ideas. Yeah. Because it's self-limiting. And it makes you a weaker magician. And I think one of my largest complaints, the reason I got away from ceremonial magic and got more into the primary sources and assembling how I understood magic and practice through primary sources, is because, there is a limit that you have within OTO, Golden Dawn.
Absolutely.
It's called the abyss.
That's the limit, right?
It's a completely insular, self-referential system, And so it's like a box, and you're in there in the box casting spells.
Yeah,
and
you're trapped in the Saturn cube, and now you're crying because you're trapped in a hexagram, and you thought you were going to have to get out of a pentagram.
You had a little, glass ceiling, and so I had to walk away from ceremonial magic because of that. I mean,
me too.
Yeah.
I think we kind of did that simultaneously, and that's how that happened.
I mean, obviously, though, look around, I still hold on to a lot of my ceremonial practices. Oh,
same.
Yeah, exactly. But
do these people know about Lacuna?
No, they do not.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it right there. Yeah. That was, the first, I think my first approach into theurgy, right? I had just, and that was a powerful shit.
Bro, it ate my wand, if you remember.
The first night.
Yep.
It did. I guess it
worked. I guess it was a one-off kind of device.
It was a one-off device?
I guess.
Yeah.
It was an iron wand.
I know. That's a pretty nice wand.
Yeah, but it served its purpose.
Yeah.
And I no longer miss it. I'm happy it did its job.
Yeah. Did you get another wand?
No.
No?
No, because wandless? I feel I can't buy a wand, right? I have to manifest the wand or I don't deserve it.
Oh,
that's
got
my
it.
Philosophy on it. Until then, I'll use my chapstick as my wand.
I know. I was always using my my god name as my wand, and then I got given a wand by somebody, and so I was like, okay, I guess it's time to use it or whatever. And now I love it. Now I love my wand. Now I'm like, I love using it. I'm gonna whip it out whenever I can. Though I came into actually, I cannot share. I personal gnosis. I don't want to mess up anybody's magical practice. But yeah.
I think it's too late for that.
Yeah. Sure. I don't think I've messed up anybody's magical practice. At least I hope not.
Bro, you messed up my magical practice.
Why?
You gave me, you were the messenger by which God himself handed me a physical copy of Sefer Yetzirah.
Oh, yes.
That was your fault. I didn't ask for this. You just gave it to me.
The Sefer Yetzirah is, I'm constantly railing about. We're doing an episode specifically on it, but how powerful that book is. It is like, I never stop using it. Ever.
The best part is I had been studying it via PDF.
Yeah.
Like up to the point of it becoming manifest corporeally.
Yes.
Thanks to you.
Yes. It's
it was beautiful.
It never stops unlocking deeper and deeper layers. And I think it is the most relevant piece of Kabbalah for somebody that practices magic.
Yes. It is by far the most practical. It's a great place to start if you possess, you know, any kind of other magical understanding, if you have some other you know system, it's a great place to start. If you're completely new to everything, then I don't know if I would 100% recommend it, but it's not
I would
hurt
never
you to
start
read.
I would never start anybody, I would never start a Gentile or a magician on the Zohar.
You know what the best thing to start people on is the chicken Kabbalah. I'm serious,
everybody's dude. So that was my first exposure to Kabbalah when I first got into magic. Everybody's like, chicken Kabbalah. And I remember I had the same experience that you had when you found Kabbalah.
Yep.
And you're like, this is
obviously
this
true.
Is it. Like this is how this is explaining what I'm feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what made me fall in love with Kabbalah. Because I was actually, I came at it from a conspiracy theorist angle. I was, you know, in the red zone of conspiracy theories.
Okay.
And I was hunting, you know.
Yeah, I was coming from like the Norse Seder type stuff.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wait a second. Yeah. You're telling me these 9 things and these 24 things are not in any way, shape, or form related to these 10 things and 22 things?
Yeah.
I don't buy it.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of these is just a recursive version of the tree where you just remove it and then you now need these other two paths and it's a whole thing. Anyway,
but
get me started on the Icelandic Solomonic magic. I think Icelandic runes. It's literally in the Key of Solomon.
It is?
A bunch of them. Not all, but a big chunk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
Uh-huh.
Viking Jews. Those are actually my people on my mom's side.
Yeah.
She's Norwegian and Ashkenazi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I had no idea. That's crazy. I never get north of Italy with my esotericism. The second I start getting into Germanic and Norse stuff, I'm just like, this is so not me, you know? And I'm just like, that's for somebody else, you know?
That's fair. I respect that.
I'm very much like I like, you know, being around the desert, you know?
I don't
the
like,
Arabs
I'm a Jew. I don't like being around the desert.
You don't like being around the desert?
I'm done with the desert.
You're done with it.
My ancestors did enough time.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Thanks, Moses.
Yeah.
Freaking got us lost. He's like, oh, actually, guys, we're not lost. It's this way.
Yeah.
As he was smoking every DMT bush in Mesopotamia.
The DMT bush.
You know about those, right?
Yes, I do. Yeah. It is the acacia. They
the acacia
think that
bushes.
The, they think that the burning bush was the acacia tree, and the acacia tree contains the precursors for DMT. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Who knows? Freudian Moses.
Well, I told you I was getting back into the Merkava and Hekalot because I had a little piece of gnosis that opened my eyes to what was going on in there, and instantly I knew. I was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm probably going to need psychedelics.
Yeah.
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 Because I could see in my head, I could see that these guys were loaded while they were doing what was revealed to me.
And envision this, right? So let's say, just for the sake of discussion, lots of heresy about to follow, that
this
Moses
conversation is very heretical.
Oh, we're well past, you know, no more disclaimers.
Yeah.
Imagine yourself as Moses, the high priest of Aten and under Pharaoh Akhenaten, who then dies, and then his successors say, now we're going to go back to not being monotheistic Egypt now.
Oh, yes.
And then you make friends with an Ugaritic scribe.
Uh-huh.
And then you and a bunch of these, like, once Scythian people who'd been living there for a while left and crossed the sea to the desert.
Confirm this really quick. Uh-huh. The Scythian connection, this is your own personal gnosis. This is not historically recognized, right?
Of course not.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's occult knowledge. Why would it be historically recognized?
I'm just saying. Yeah. I'm just
sure.
So there's a little clarification just so like people aren't like, you know, this guy is an idiot or whatever.
So with where Noah landed the ark in like Mount Ararat, and this is like a place in, you know, Turkey, which is where a lot of Scythians, you know, congregate throughout the years. There's also the sense in which it's Arata, which is even a little bit more north of that in the Ukraine, which is very interesting for today's world. But we will not get into that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Don't want to get defeated by the algorithm of all things.
Yeah, no, we actually don't do politics on this.
Yeah, it's good.
Politics aren't spiritual. Good. Yeah.
Either way, Abraham's genealogy is given right after the story of the Tower of Babel, which is given right after, you know, Noah and his descendants, you know, land the ark after that whole big epidemic they had to deal with.
Yeah.
And then Abraham goes to the land that God shows him, away from his homeland.
Uh-huh.
Down south into Mesopotamia.
Yes.
And that's where God says, this section of the lot, sir. Right.
Okay, so when you were explaining to this to me before, I was like, you know, Abraham's from Ur, like that's just the generally accepted, but you're saying before that Abraham's ancestors were
Scythian. That's the thing, actually. It doesn't say, this is one of those mistranslations.
Yeah.
It does not actually say Ur of the Chaldees.
Oh, okay.
And for anyone who is exceptionally versed in ancient Mesopotamian history, I guess, you already know this, but the Chaldeans weren't even around until like, I think it was 700 years or so
they're
later.
They're Neo-Babylonian, and they're thought to be Arab migrants that went and took over the Fertile Crescent.
So how could Abraham be Chaldean if Chaldeans didn't exist for another 700 years?
So does it say that he was a Chaldean in the
Well, so that word
Torah?
For Chaldean,
yeah,
it says he's from Ur-Kasdim, Ur being R, light, right? That's
yeah.
the establishing, but there's a lot of cities named that in like Urata.
Yeah.
But Chaldea, the word in Hebrew is Kasdim or Kasdima, one of the two. And it's a conjugation of the word Shadim with a kaf as a prefix, meaning as or like, and a im as the masculine, ima as, you know, the plural suffix.
Ima.
Yeah. And so the Shadim are referenced a few times throughout, you know, the Old Testament and the Tanakh as figures you might be familiar with, like Moloch.
Uh-huh.
And Baal-zebub and these demons, or left-handed things.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, I think we are going to take a quick little break right now. This is really great. We will be back.
Okie dokie.
For more gnosis. We're taking a quick break from the Discourse podcast, and we'll be back shortly. In the meantime, be sure to check out Elijah's recommended reading on Kabbalah, including Sefer Yetzirah with commentary by Aryeh Kaplan and Gershom Scholem's provocative essay, The Holiness of Sin. And now, we return to Discourse. Welcome back from our break. So we were actually just talking right now before we came back, we're just talking about Franz Barden got brought up, initiation into hermetics, and that is that's something I always find myself going back to. It's one of the beginner books, so absolutely. It's like when you are a beginner occultist, there's a bunch of different paths that you can take, and people will recommend you certain types of books, right? Like different books, like Chicken Kabbalah is one of the beginner books people get recommended a lot. Golden God by Israel Regardi, but Initiation into Hermetics by Franz Barden,
so practical.
That gets recommended to beginners a lot. And some beginners will run with that, and then they'll be like, this is great. And then others will look at it and be like, this doesn't look like magic to me, or this is not what I'm getting into magic for, right? But it's funny because, like, Bardonian magic is its own thing, right? Yeah. So somebody who's practices Franz Bardon is like its own style of magic. They're like their own insular kind of current. And it's funny, the more... So I was a big initiation into Hermetics fanboy because it's teaching you a lot about visualization, right? But has also he's got his third book's on Kabbalah, and I think that one's really practical too.
Yeah,
that one I feel like Franz Barton's Hermetic Kabbalah is a lot more in line with Jewish meditative Kabbalah than the Hermetic Kabbalah is.
100%.
Yeah. So I think his book on Kabbalah is absolutely useful if somebody's trying to get away from, you know, the Hermetic Kabbalah, occult Kabbalah, where it's like just basically a table of correspondences and that's all it is, you know? But I think that's like a good Hermetic Kabbalah, Barton's. But I keep going back to initiation and Hermetics. Like when I reach a new stage in my practice or like cross a certain threshold, then I remember something that Franz Barton once did or wrote about. And I'm like, this guy was so advanced and nobody gives him credit for it. Yeah, he slept on as hell, you know, and it's like so practical too, like absolutely practical. So I don't know. I just felt like we were just talking about that. I just like wanted to get it on the record. Big initiation into Hermetics fanboy. I think people should pick it up.
I think that and like Buckland's Complete Book of Witchcraft is also a really great
place to start. Yeah,
it's like introductory Wicca. Mm-hmm. But it's Golden Dawn with a texture pack.
Oh, okay.
And it's funny as heck, you know, reading that.
Yeah.
And having known about these other things, I'm like, these people think this is like a new, unique druid thing or something, whatever.
Oh, yeah, but, exactly. Well, I mean, I'm definitely of the belief that like, because every time I try to innovate like something, it like within magic, every time, you know, I get the hubris to think that, you know, I'm going to develop a new technique or I'm going to like do some like crazy experiment. Like I start doing it and then it gets revealed to me. And then all of a sudden I realize everybody's been doing it. It's literally out there plain as day in the primary sources. And I'm just like there is no innovation. It's just rediscovering
that we've already been at this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Why do we do these things? Tradition.
Tradition, yeah. Well, I view it as like I view everything as received, right? I'm very much in line with the classical mindset of like anything that I write or any magic that I learn is not coming from me; it's coming from
that something which is else. Given.
Yeah, something that's given to me,
and thus by the graces.
Yeah,
And life is about how you play your cards, not what cards you get dealt, because nobody knows. Thanks to the Clipo. Without the Clipo, everyone would know what cards you have.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's parchment. It's the back of the playing card specifically.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So without the backs of the playing cards, you just have the front.
So what would you, like, you talk about the Clipo, and I know it's like a really important part of your, like, personal practice. I mean, how, like, what is your practical application of breaking this light out of those shells or whatever?
I think the easiest one that's safest to try at home, everybody, is to look at all of your quote-unquote negative or bad or the evil inclinations within oneself, whether that's lust, greed, wrath, whatever, right? And to realize that all those things are ultimately stemming from some kind of true intention, some true will that you possess. Now, when that true will is not addressed and acted upon, it's like how Freud talks about, you know, psychological repression. Sure, you may succeed in the short term, but it's just gonna come back angrier, right? And suppression doesn't really work. And so instead of fighting it, it's about really meditating on what, like meditating on the negative, letting your mind go there, and then seeing what is underneath it, the seed that begets it. Because this negative bad part is nothing more than the crust, the shell encasing some kind of, you know, aspect of the will. As it's, you know, permuted through one of the different Sephiroth.
So, I guess in therapy speak, it would be a maladaptive coping mechanism or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but those all stem from the instincts to survive, the will to live, right?
Yeah.
Kind of important. It's better to have them than not. They're the lesser evil, right? Having evil in the first place is the lesser evil.
Yeah.
Not having evil creates a very different kind of a world, not one that is good, because good can't exist without it, right? They're opposites and they're defined fundamentally by each other.
Yeah.
And must coexist.
Yes. I love this so much. So the thing is, I mean, I guess the currents that we engage in are on paper diametrically opposed, but the gnosis is the same.
Yes, because thanks, Hegel.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, exactly. Didn't you say the other night that you were a Hegel fan or something?
I love Hegel.
Yeah, and I was like, what is your problem? It was like a few weeks ago. I don't like to engage with anybody beyond like probably the medieval period, just because maybe beyond... Yeah, it was the Renaissance guys. It's the Enlightenment, but it started in the Renaissance where everything just got so dualistic and mechanized.
I like Hegel and like Schopenhauer.
Yeah, yeah.
Nietzsche is too much of a baby. Whiny crybaby.
I know, right? I know.
I mean, honestly, you could even call this whole way of thinking maybe post-nihilist. Because when I was going through that whole arc, as I'm sure a number of you guys have... I realized that, very simply, it didn't matter that nothing mattered.
Yes.
And I was just feeling sorry for myself.
Yeah.
And then that was the end of that, and then the only truth became, do what thou wilt. Mm-hmm. That's your life, decide what you're going to do with it. Right? And you can't embrace that will and determine thus what to do with your life and live in accordance with it to be fulfilled and happy and have joy and peace and the rest of those things. Unless you unveil it from all these different layers of, you know, crap that it's encased in.
Yes.
And that requires us to do shadow work. Shadow work is fundamentally klepothic. Right? So.
So, you mean more of like integrating these quote unquote negative aspects of yourself? Yeah.
The Jungian shadow integration of the archetypes.
Okay.
Yes, sir. That.
Yeah. So I think like with me personally addressing those things, I address them from a kind of like theurgic and alchemical standpoint, is where I take my weaknesses and transmute them into seeds, into powers, you know.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the first historical alchemists was Mary the Jewess.
Yes.
Who is
I'm familiar.
Mary the Jewess, right? It's alchemy fundamentally, right? And you look at the Hermetic correspondences with the letters.
Yeah.
That's one thing they pretty much got.
Yeah.
Right. You know, because it says in the first chapter of the book, I'm putting these things in the heavens for the signs and the times, etc. This is something lost in translation. The word for signs is the same as the word for letter.
Yeah.
In Hebrew, the letters are the celestial and astrological points, the planets, the constellations.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, yes, and the power of those letters. I specifically choose the Hebrew alphabet, and I chose it like at the beginning of my occult career.
Good choice.
I know. I feel like it was a good choice. However, it's like funny because I mainly practice Arabic magic, and the division of 28 is
very different.
Yes, the division of 28 is very important to Arabic magic, and so trying to like synthesize the 22 with the 28, it doesn't necessarily work out. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily work out a lot, and so I just kind of stopped trying to make it make sense. And I'm like, I like Hebrew is my magic language and is my magic alphabet, and then you know I deal with the Arabic framework and spirits and that kind of thing. And
lacunacy.
Yeah, exactly. I actually, it was like so funny because I was having a conversation with a certain thing. I think
what
like
kind of a certain thing?
A celestial thing. And I was getting frustrated with it because I was working on a project. I really wanted to teach people how to do my brand of magic. And I was systematizing it, and this thing got upset at me. It was like, it's not gonna work if you systematize it. And I was getting frustrated with it. It was like, I've been given this thing, and it's like liberated me, and I want other people to have it. And then this thing was like, you named the system. It's called Lacuna. Why do you think that is? She's like, where do you think that comes from?
You've been memed.
And I'm just like, God, I was like, you're so right.
I was telling you that Anu Kol.
Yeah. It keeps coming back. Yes. Okay, I guess we'll talk about it. Yeah. I've brought it up before in one of the episodes. I very briefly name dropped the Libra Lacuna, which is not public. So I only hand it on to, only give it to people that need it. At this point, I do plan to make it public at some point. But basically, Lacuna was an egregoric magical project me and you put together. Actually, there was the episode on egregores. If you go back, I think I briefly mentioned about the most recent egregoric project I worked on. That was this Lacuna thing that me and Eli were doing together or whatever. So, yeah. And that was pretty...
Those were some good times.
It was some good... I mean, that was very... I crossed a threshold with that project. That's when I went from like a weak magician that was running around conjuring a couple $100s at a time and bashing their head against the wall into an actualized, realized magician that's life was a constant like conversation with the cosmos and God and that kind of thing.
You've achieved something along the Gevurah, Tiferet, Netzach axis.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I use the Chaldean spheres instead of the Sephiroth, you know, very much a
potato potato.
Potato potato, yeah, exactly. I'm like so obstinate, I guess, about Hermetic Kabbalah that I like try as hard as possible not to like look at my magic through that freaking diagram, you know? And I'm just like, oh, like stop. But the diagram works, and I'm just like, no, you don't do that. Yeah,
it's because it's one of the greatest works of chaos magic of all time.
Oh, really?
That's my opinion on the Hermetic tree. Do I agree with any of it? No.
Yes.
Does it work? Yes.
Yes.
And all systems are arbitrary.
Yes, they are. They are. All systems are arbitrary.
All divisions are nothing more than little schizophrenic breakdowns of things in your own mind.
Yes. It's you trying to rationalize what's happening. And I think, like, with my, like, I'm at a point where, like, I don't need to understand. I don't need a theory of everything for my magic. I don't need to understand how the spiritual, like what the spiritual hierarchies are. The only thing I care about is that I'm moving forward, that I'm taking the next step, right?
That is true wisdom, sir.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. And so but the systems that we developed are basically like we need those for our brains.
Yep.
We do not need that for the magic. We do not need that for the experience, but we need it for our brains, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when I try to relate what I am going through, it comes out in a system dependent on my understanding. And that framework works for me and me only, right?
Right. You've completed the great work of the Magister Templi.
Yes.
Sir.
Oh, maybe. Yes.
Mr. Captain Nemo.
Mr. Captain Nemo. But that's also... you know, and so I look at the system, the great systematizers, like I really love Eliphas Levi. I do practice any of that, like any of his understanding. I know that is Eliphas Levi's understanding, you know, and that is how he understood things. And he was trying to relate it to people. That does not mean that it's going to work for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everyone's path is different. The Tao has many permutations.
Yes. Yeah.
Many of them are not ideal, but
that's
why we have to toughen up, you know, put on our armor, put on our shell, right? Thicken the skin, and that's how we deal with life.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting Kabbalistic metaphor when you consider Atzilut is the shadow or the shade, which is the result of a light shining through this covering or shell.
Yes. Yes.
We want to be extra visual about it.
Yeah, I mean, that goes into, you know, Platonism too. But I mean, Kabbalah is just Jewish Platonism. Like, that's it. I'm going to say it.
Platonism is just...
just Greek
Kabbalah.
Greek Kabbalah. Exactly. There you go.
Oh, the Praedicamenta is actually super interesting.
Yeah.
It's like Aristotle's like 10 categories for the qualities of all things that exist.
Yeah.
And it's subdivided into like 4 modalities of each. And I said,
Oh, yes. Those numbers.
I've never seen this one before.
Those Greek number wizards, you know, accessing the background code. Yeah.
People
you know?
Forget Pythagoras was a cult leader before he was a renowned mathematician.
Yes. Yes. 100%. Yeah.
Now, I could get behind that kind of math. That would be would be something else.
What?
Imagine being
cult
in like Pythagoras's.
Oh, it be being in
gematria
his gematria
cult.
In his gematria cult. Yeah. I know that the reality of the alphabets and the language languages are a human reality that on the spiritual plane they don't recognize it. They don't recognize our attachment to Hebrew or Arabic or English or whatever the hell it is. You know, they don't recognize it. That's not within their realm. However, so where the Pythagoreans were obsessed with their numbers, that's how I'm looking at the alphabets. The alphabets are the same thing, you know, the exact same thing as the Pythagorean numbers. They're just,
yeah.
It's about those like relationships. It's about the letters as matrices on a chaos matrix, you know?
Yeah. It's Berea embedded in that sea loop.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know.
Look up the four worlds. Kabbalah, if you
the four
want
worlds
to know
of
what
Kabbalah.
This is.
Yes.
Yeah. It's something definitely talked about in the Chicken Kabbalah as well as Sefer Yetzirah.
Yeah, so the Chicken Kabbalah of Rabbi Lamed by Lon Milo Duquette.
Who, and he actually lives like 2 hours from us.
Yes, he lives in...
Newport.
Yeah. He lives pretty close, but he's a great, very prolific writer. I actually have a lot of issue with a lot of the experts that we tout within our little cottage industry. Duquette is not one of them. Duquette is Duquette is like one of the guys that I'm like, yes, like he is the, you know, cottage industry kind of standard, but he's, you know, That is a trusted, reputable source, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he's very candid just in the way that he writes. He does not take himself seriously. Yeah. He doesn't think he's, you know...
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's not trying to convince you of something or whatever.
He doesn't
whatever.
Have majorcitis.
Majorcitis. I think I might have a little bit of that.
Maybe Duquette is an ipsismus.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's just the truth of the situation.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yes.
But... and then for the Sefer Yetzirah, you want to read the Arya Kaplan edition.
So we're me and Dr. Stone are planning specifically an episode on the Sefer Yetzirah, why it's so important. We're trying to do a few episodes on deep dives on primary sources, but for the Gentile, the Goyim or the magician, the rabbi. No disrespect. Yes, exactly. I mean, I'm a Gentile. I'm a Goyim.
I'm part Gentile.
I'm not Jewish.
Say anything.
I'm not Jewish. I just go hang out at their temple sometimes. You know
exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
The Orthodox wouldn't consider me kosher Jew.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, the temple that I go to for they have these group meditations on Wednesday nights, and that's it's a Reform temple. So
nice.
The Reform guys are the only ones that'll let me anywhere near their Kabbalah or whatever.
Well, so this is the thing. I think I can tie all this together.
Yeah.
Okay. You've said the final trigger. So, there is a reason, a very good reason, that the Orthodoxy and conservative sects in Judaism pretty much universally dislike the Reforms. And not just because they're Reformed and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
It actually comes from a significantly more deep-seated place. And this is because Reform Judaism did not grow directly out of Rabbinical Judaism.
Yeah.
It grew out of Sabbatean Judaism.
Mm.
And the Sabbateans, for those of you who don't know, are pretty much the only, I think, literally universally condemned sect by every other partition of the religious system.
So I'm very familiar with this. And there's a ton of misinformation about this on the internet. And it is conspiracy theory fodder.
The
reason that Judaism doesn't like the Shabbatean is because Shabbatai Sivi tricked them. basically. He tricked them, right? That's the reason Judaism doesn't like the Shabbateans. It's not because they're doing SRA.
Sure.
It's because they were duped and they're upset about it. Like, actual Shabbateans are an actual real thing that exists today, and it is a blend between Sufism and Kabbalah. It is not dark, evil Rothschilds, like, abusing children. Yeah. That is not... But the thing is, if you look it up online, like, a lot of this just descends from that anthropologist Robert Sepperher.
Read Gershom Scholem's article, The Holiness of Sin.
That's an
excellent read, significantly more academic and not really hearsay, and is largely a critique of the way that these people have been talked about. But if there ever was such a thing as left-hand Kabbalah, it would be Sabbatean.
It would be Shabbat.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's literally Saturnian. Frankism.
Frankism. Yeah.
I wrap them up into the same.
Yeah.
Because with my family, like,
I just don't think it's not an accurate way to describe the beliefs of the Shabbatians.
Messianic Judaism.
Yeah, it's Messianic Judaism, but like, actual practicing Shabbateans from the lineage or whatever, they're not people that are, like, they're literally a blend between Sufism and like, and if you know anything about Sufism, it is an extremely beautiful, peaceful, kind expression of Islam. Truly. Fused with Kabbalah, right?
Absolutely, and lots of spinning.
Yeah, lots of spinning. It's a very, very specific sect, but yeah, I don't know. I always have a problem because it's that exact rabbit hole.
Oh yeah,
that got me into Kabbalah. Because I was investigating, because I was a part of the conspiracy theory groups online. And I started, and you know, what do conspiracy theorists like to say? Say, go look it up, right? The thing is, they didn't think that I actually would go look it up, right? I actually learned Hebrew to read sources.
They never do.
And so I went and did it, and I found out that this whole Shabbatean elite conspiracy stems from one book in the 1980s written by an anti-Semite. This is not a historical current. The reason that the Jews do not like the Shabbateans is because they're upset because Shabbatai Shevi duped.
He pulled a fast one.
Yeah, he duped everybody. And that there are actual Shabbateans, and they're not elite Illuminati types. They're very peaceful, almost villager class of mystical people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially those directly to be called Sabbateans. Frankism, you get into some...
Frankism, you might be able to pull out some Illuminati connections.
There might be a couple
there.
Rothschilds down that rabbit hole. That's not something that we should probably talk about on here, and you should go look up if you're interested.
Yeah, so I went, so it was investigating into Shabbatai Shevi and the Shabbateans, reading the actual sources, trying to find the actual people and the actual practices, that I discovered Kabbalah. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is everything. You know, and I like actual Jewish Kabbalah, and I realized, you know, just how, like, misinformed, you know, this entire current of, like, you know, watch out for the Shabbateans is, you know.
It's a giant, you know, witch hunt.
Yes.
It's a scapegoat in very good Leviticus 16 fashion.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, Azazel.
Yeah.
But one of the simplest way to put the essence of why you could call this, like, a left-handed path.
Yeah.
And I think Gershom Scholem really outlines it very explicitly, is that in the Sabbatean framework, the Torah exists, and in all the frameworks, right? The Torah exists on the various layers of the world, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the Torah Berea is the one that we have, and we can open up and read, and is here, the created Torah, the Torah in creation.
Yeah. Right?
Their understanding is that in order to adhere to the Torah of Atzilut, this inky, weird, shadowy, strange place, the only way to do this is by directly and intentionally violating the laws in the Torah of Berea. The rationale for this being that these are an arbitrary, subdivided partition of some kind of a divine truth that has trapped a group of people in an ideological box for thousands of years, which can only be transcended by directly engaging in, like, completely 100% explicitly antinomian behavior.
So subversive behavior, but at the same point, I mean, like, we can directly compare this to the agoric practices.
Absolutely.
The tantric practices, absolutely, which are like where the left-hand path comes from. That's 100%. Where it was misappropriated from. And the thing is, like, we don't run around and say that an agoric guru over there eating a corpse or whatever is like this is a death cult that is leading the world in sin. We understand that they are practicing a subversive act in order to find Brahma within the taboo, within the darkness, right? And so a very profane and mundane viewpoint is to see this teaching and to be like, so people that believe in this teaching are out there murdering people and that kind of stuff. That's a very profane, mundane way to look at it, because really it is an extremely esoteric teaching, and you know, it's talking about approaching taboo.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what Crowley's brand, like, that's what Crowley's sex magic was supposed to do. Absolutely. But that's why Crowley's sex magic doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Right? Because what he was doing in the Victorian era, it was like, oh, you want to be the highest mystery is having gay butt sex with your assistant. You know, that is the highest, because during the 19th century in Victorian conservative society,
right, that was as Sabbatean as it could get.
That's as transgressive as you can get.
Yeah.
But when you're walking around in the modern United States, where we got, you know, people in leather daddy costumes marching down the streets, that's not a subversive, transgressive thing.
So, I mean, you can see that influence that we see in certain political groups that's certainly tied to Reform Judaism.
Yeah.
Now, this is just a natural logical progression of this exact same line.
Yeah.
And the greatest irony of it all is that in the orthodoxy, when you get into, like, the, like, top shelf orthodoxy type secret stuff.
Yeah.
Or, well, apparently not top shelf, because I know about it.
Yeah.
Like, and you can look it up. They are well aware of the fact that God intentionally designed the world with sin, evil, death, pain, and suffering in mind, and that it was a good thing, and that it exists for us to go through to redeem something out of.
Yes.
They know that. This is a known thing, but because that is a really hard pill for people to swallow, especially people who have suffered tremendously.
Yes.
They don't talk about it because, and rightly so, because it would, you know, mislead more people than it would help.
You know, 100%. Yeah, I know. As we're talking about this publicly on a podcast.
Yes.
I think, yes. So whereas this whole, like, gnosis on esoteric suffering or whatever, I guess put into my personal practice, this is what I go through in my initiatory
absolutely
ordeals. The thing is, like, I am not expounding suffering outwardly onto people, but I am literally invoking suffering for the sake of putrefaction,
absolutely,
for myself to forge my spirit so that I can hit another level of magic or whatever. And it's the same kind of teaching, but the thing is, like, I can't tell people, even with something that's considered divine and godly, like theurgy, I can't tell people or a normal person that, you know, the pain and the suffering you go through is chosen and it's a good thing, because then all of a sudden you start getting, what about kids with cancer? And, like,
right,
what about
easy counter argument.
Yeah, and exactly.
The answer is you don't. This is not it, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. The game continues. Okay. Yes. There's another level. Okay. Yes. The game is not over.
Yeah.
It may sound like some BS justification, but it really is true.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most difficult things for me to accept, because I had been through a tremendous amount of suffering from, you know, that condition.
Uh-huh.
And in the end, I say in the end at 26, but in the end, it's actually changed my life in such a positive way.
Yeah.
Now, there's no way I would have ever voluntarily subjected myself to that, but it's what I needed to become who I am.
Yes, yes.
And so we can either let the pain make us or break us.
Yeah.
And if you don't make it this time, there's always the next iteration.
That is
the wheel in the sky keeps on turning.
That is an extremely callous thing to say, but yes, that is the esoteric of the situation.
I think that is the cold, hard, esoteric truth.
Yeah.
And again, this is why that post-nihilistic thought of it doesn't matter that nothing matters is really important, because I don't know how else you're supposed to get through suffering.
Yeah.
You could say this is the most fundamentally anti-traditional Buddhist philosophical stance you could take.
Well, yeah, so that's the thing. I say, I always like to say that the Christians are too obsessed with suffering and the Buddhists do not care about suffering enough, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. There's gotta be a middle ground. That's why I could never become a Buddhist. And it's because, within the Vajrayana, mm-hmm. and the tantric practices, they're doing something that's very similar to theurgy, especially with their god form assumptions. However, I guess within the Western praxis, you know, within the very first step of alchemy is putrefaction. Putrefaction, right? And that's so the Western alchemist, you know, summons suffering and dances mm-hmm. in it versus the, you know, the goal of, you know, the Vajrayana and the Buddhists, which is to remove the desires so you eliminate
the
suffering.
Albedo.
And exactly.
The absolute to Berea transgression. Yeah. And for where these fall onto the tree, that, you know, missing section in the middle on most diagrams you'll see.
Yeah.
That's in a great number of cases, this exact dichotomy is the inability to reconcile these two sides of things. And the only way that can be achieved is through the knowledge of good and evil.
The knowledge of good and evil. Yeah. So I'm very much it's something that I don't personally approach a lot. I've just kind of come into a point where I don't really believe in that kind of dichotomy on a ultimate
Certainly.
Level.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. The way I see it is that the only way you can define that which is good and evil is if you have some kind of a will, some kind of an intention, a desire, a wish for something to be a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
Things that are in accordance with that are good. Things that are not are bad.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's just strategic thinking, you know, is
the knowledge 100%. Of good and evil. Yeah, that's something.
Weighing the pros and cons. Yeah. On the balance sheet and making an informed financial decision.
When something threatens your immediate safety or wants or needs, that's when we classify it as, or your expectation, that's when we classify it as bad or evil or that kind of stuff. Like if your neighbor gets murdered or somebody gets murdered or something, you're classifying that as evil because it poses a threat to this order that you've constructed through.
Exactly.
Yeah, through your mind. But if we go up one level beyond humans or let's say outside of humanity into the animal kingdom, right? The concept of evil does not exist because when the rat witnesses the lion attacking the gazelle, the rat doesn't think that's evil.
Right,
it's just the circle of life. It just is.
Atsilut is a rough place, not for the faint of heart.
Yeah. But I've tried so hard on this podcast, not for me personally getting this, because I know when I talk about this kind of stuff, it infuriates people.
Oh, it does. Yeah. I mean, I like to call this, just to call a spade, it's goal-oriented morality.
Yeah.
Right, that which helps you achieve your goal is good.
Yeah,
that which is not as bad. People say, "Well, isn't that something a sociopath would say?"
Yeah,
only if we're all sociopaths, because it's not as simple as, "Oh, I want this one thing."
Yeah,
if you actually look at what people actually want and value, they want to have connections with people, right? They want to have friends, they want to have a family, or they want to just be alone, or whatever it is, right?
Yes,
all the different moralities that people have come up with in these, moral philosophies, especially, are nothing more than an extension of this.
Yes.
And when you really try and encapsulate the general consensus as to what people have as a goal, you end up, when you do the proverbial math, with something that looks virtually identical to common sense morality.
Yes. Yeah.
Just because everyone has it doesn't mean it's some ultimate truth. It just means it's a set of shared values generally on a species-wide scale.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's important for social function and everything, but once you start approaching something more cosmic, something more transcendent, then it kind of collapses that. And that is the point of engaging in the left-hand path within Tantra. It's like I'm collapsing the dual function by engaging in being, even in that which is considered by social convention to be evil.
Because in order to do that, you have to be able to see yourself as not in the same bucket, which requires you to take some kind of an action to divorce your own internal sense of identity from whatever it is you came from.
Yes.
Which is the basis of conversion in virtually any religion.
Yeah.
And baptism especially is a huge one, which is a very ancient thing that goes back before
I love it.
Jesus.
That's great. Yeah. Well, of course, yeah. No, well, I mean, John the Baptist was before Jesus.
Well, of course. I hope so, or I've really misread the book.
Yeah.
But, like, back in, like, Sumerian stuff, like, you went into, like, the temple of the Abzu of, like, the abyss, which was, like, hosted by Enki, who would, you know, drown you and resuscitate you ceremonially while you're probably tripping on something. I mean, there's the whole thing with Kaikeion. And, like, the Eleusinian Mysteries, which is an extension of the same thing. Like, that's why it was about this, oh, I'm dead, now I'm born again, I'm back to life, I'm resurrected. Because people were ceremonially drowned.
Well, you get liberated from that.
A forcible way to do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Through suffering.
Yes. I mean,
catharsis cannot be attained except through suffering. There it is.
That's crazy. I love that. It seems extremely dark, but I think we're all, everybody's, the higher mysteries and the higher, or whatever, are all hidden specifically because, like, this is a large part of them, and the public does not react.
The Klipo exists to protect the normies.
Okay.
There's a reason that certain things are classified to this day.
Yeah.
It's because people wouldn't really react well.
Yes.
And I mean, should anyone really be shocked to know that the truth is something that's way more well understood than they themselves already have, and it's way darker, and they're going to be very unhappy with it?
I wouldn't say it's way darker. I wouldn't say it's way darker. Like, my practice does not focus on embracing darkness and bad things, but when that darkness and bad happens to me, that is a utility to find God in the situation. And the thing is, like, you keep talking about, like, will and your true will. I mean, my morality is literally just an invocation of God's will. There is no framework. Absolutely. There is no structure to it. My morality, my will is God's will. What is God's will for me? A consistent invocation of God's will. And when I am not living within God's will, I don't feel good. I feel disconnected. I feel sick, right?
I completely agree. And I think that one of the most important understandings that someone has to come to in some way or another to really embrace that true will is to understand that if God's will is sovereign, if it is Malkut, conditional statement, then everything that occurs across all planes of existence are 100% directly and intentionally done in accordance with God's will. Yes. God wants every single terrible thing that happens to us to happen. But that doesn't mean that's necessarily the end of things.
Yes.
And I don't think any of us should even have the hubris or the capacity to have the hubris to think we could understand why things have to be the way that they are. But I think wisdom tells us that we should know better and that we can't understand. And we just have to simply accept it. Yes. Because when in the beginning of God's creating the earth, the heavens and the earth, you know, the earth became null and void and darkened.
Yes.
And this is the state of things. This darkness precipitates and precedes the light. And that transition from before to after the light, we can now see things.
Yes.
Right? Things are cognizable in some sense. In the darkness, they're not.
Uh-huh.
Right? The thing that brings about that illumination, it is not a light that shines through the darkness and dispels it. It is a continuous compression and condensation of that darkness that, when it reaches a critical point, begets light. This is literally how stars form.
Yeah.
It's compression and compression and compression until there's the release. There's the suffering until the catharsis. This is what liberation is, in essence, and achieving that illumination.
Yes.
Out of the darkness. And yeah.
Wow. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. I've learned so much about you and so much about what the left-hand path has to, I guess, offer. It's not something that I consciously engage in, but well, I feel like we are very...
That's why it's the left-hand
path. Yeah, exactly. However, I mean, what I'm hearing is that it's something that I always say is that there is no such thing as left-hand path, right-hand path.
Yeah.
It's
all God's will.
Yeah, but I think just the fact that for all aesthetic purposes,
oh, sure,
we may look at different ends of the aisle, our gnosis communicates the same type of, yes, experience. And that's how you can recognize mystical experience, right? Because mystics don't quarrel. That's for theologians. Mystics.
Yeah, exactly.
Mystics are talking about, they speak the same exact language.
Yeah.
And I think this is like really eye-opening, especially for anybody that's listening or watching, to hear how the left-hand path, it does offer this kind of transformation and this kind of gnosis, yeah, and actually does bring you closer to God, you know,
yeah,
when engaged in, you know, with the motivations that you have. So,
yeah. And if we can't accept God's will,
yeah,
then how could we possibly accept our own when our own is nothing more than a partition of God's will?
Yeah.
As the vessels of God on the earth, right? You know?
Yeah.
Our will is His. His will is imputed into us, and mm-hmm, it's cut off from the rest as far as what it can see.
Yeah.
And that's why it seems like, you know, these things are opposed, but in reality, it's not. It's more like gears turning together in a machine.
Yeah.
And so if we can accept that there is no difference between our will and God's will, one can achieve alignment with the true will.
Oh my gosh. Beautiful. That is, yes. Love it. Thank you, Eli. I really appreciate it. This has been a great episode. So
I'm glad this has been fantastic.
Yeah, no, this has been great. I'm really glad we had this conversation. I think the audience is really going to like this, hopefully, or they're going to get really pissed off.
Or yeah, probably both, more but, likely than not. It's a divisive concept.
It is a very divisive concept. A lot of people don't like it. Anyways, so that was Discourse. We'll be back next week. We have a few more episodes coming up. We've got Sphere of Venus, obviously, talked about. We're going to do a deep dive on the Sefer Yetzirah. We're also doing a deep dive onto Neoplatonism. And we have a few more guests upcoming, too. So thank you guys for joining us. Have a good week.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you, sir.
You've been listening to Discourse, where we venture into the mysteries of esotericism, the occult, and the depths of spiritual exploration. I am Abimon the Great, joined as always by Dr. Anna Stone, bringing adept insights to help guide your journey. Remember, the path of wisdom is illuminated by both knowledge and experience. Until next time, continue your exploration and stay attuned to the unseen.